You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. We have a returning guest to the podcast. We welcome Tomas Chamorro Promusic back to the podcast. Tomas is the Chief Innovation Officer at Manpower Group, a professor of business psychology at University College London and Columbia University. And he has a new book. It's provocatively titled, Don't Be Yourself, Why Authenticity is Overrated and What to Do Instead. Enjoy the pod. Tomas, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I really enjoyed the book, and I think my favorite line comes on the very last page. You write, quote, by all means, keep it real. Just don't make everyone else suffer for it, end quote. That's the book in a nutshell.
It is, and I think, you know, when you put it that way, it's probably less controversial for most people than when they see the title. So let's see if the contrarian hook can, you know, appeal to the readers that are skeptical. But then I think in the end, if they finish it, they should be persuaded, I hope.
Look, it's a funny line, and one of the things that makes comedy work is that there's this hint of truth that we see in it that maybe someone hasn't said out loud. And
yeah,
let's start with this, which is, authenticity, prized commodity, right? People yeah. talk about this in all different sort of facets of life, whether it's marketing and advertising, it's watches, as you say, and rare truffles. It sells. But there's a problem with that, right? When it translates to human behavior in the workplace and other places.
Yeah. And so that is a good starting point. And I think first, you know, the reason why we might crave authenticity is because actually we don't get it that often. But I think it's one of these cases of be careful what you wish for, because a world in which people would truly be themselves in the sense of kind of displaying their unfiltered, uninhibited, and uncensored thoughts and emotions would really be a barbarian, almost medieval age. You know, I mean, society and civilization have progressed in a way that enable people to be kind to each other and to, you know, project their most civil or prosocial tendencies. And of course, that doesn't mean being a fraud or a phony, but actually it does mean curating or editing yourself, especially when it comes to your professional self and the workplace. I mean, it might be that, you know, the four or five people who you've known all your life, who go with you on vacation, can put up with the unfiltered version of you, but probably not for the whole vacations.
Not for the whole vacation.
If you're still friends with them, it means that, you know, you're doing something right.
Well, it's interesting. We just had James Cordova on the podcast who's talking about intimacy. And one of his things he says is, you know, we often hurt the people who are closest to us because we're closest to them. So that even then we have to work that extra hard to pull back from what might be our id-like reaction to things. And the term you use is strategic self-presentation. Yep. Over this unfiltered self-expression. So I know people are going to think that's a manipulation of some sort, but we do it already in a variety of contexts.
Yeah, and it's important to acknowledge, right? There's a lot of research and science showing that if you overdo it, it will backfire. I mean, you know, even in kind of trivial everyday situations, we've all been to restaurants and bars where the waiter or waitress might engage in sort of like excessive emotional labor, and it seems so fake that we are put yeah. off. And of course, a boss that is pretending to tell you something when they're blatantly thinking something else will have no credibility. Just the gap between what you say and what you do is an important indicator of your integrity or, you know, otherwise. Having said that, you know, people who actually come across as authentic manage to engage in strategic self-presentation in the sense that they display only the relevant aspects of their identity that a situation calls for, and they know how to not broadcast their unsolicited thoughts about, you know, the Middle East or Russia or Ukraine or politics at work, especially if they're a boss. Because if you impose those values and beliefs on others, you're more likely dividing and alienating people than creating a harmonious team or, you know, an effective workplace.
So I've been in therapy. how well do people know themselves?
Right.
And I have an answer for this, which is not well, but it's for very good reasons. We are very complicated. Humans are very complicated beasts.
Yeah. Look, I have to, since you're bringing therapy up, I have to confess, I'm still a recovering psychoanalyst. I started my career as a shrink. I was born and raised in an area of Buenos Aires, Argentina, that boasts the highest concentration of shrinks of psychoanalysts in the world. So, you know, and of course, if you want to become a psychoanalyst yourself, a psychotherapist, you have to be in therapy. So it's kind of like a pyramid scheme, you know, that keeps kind of growing. But, you know, mm-hmm. So the answer to your question is, it depends who you ask. If you ask a psychotherapist, they will say, you will never know yourself. I mean, you can be in therapy 10 years and maybe in the end you will discover, I mean, there are two possible outcomes. One is that you are neurotic and that's the best possible outcome. And it means you come to terms with the idea that you don't know who you are, but you get by. The other is that you are psychotic and, you know, you believe you are Napoleon or, Tsar Alexander or somebody else, and then you might have the illusion of certainty, but not that. Modern psychology, modern social psychology, and even neuroscience coincide or align in basically decades of evidence and research saying that, you know, the one single thing that we, most of us, have in common is that we bullshit ourselves all the time about who we are, and the story we tell ourselves about who we are generally has little resemblance to how other people see us. So our self-views are mostly disconnected with our reputations or our peer views. And this is important to understand, because if you ask people whether they're being authentic, they might feel that they're authentic, but if you ask people who work with them, they might say, you know, they're just being a jerk.
And here's the most important thing. As far as your success goes, it's what other people think.
Correct.
I mean, you can think you're the best in the world. That will have no bearing. Well, it might have some bearing in a very destructive way, which we might be seeing right now play out in our country. But for the most part, it is how other people see you. And that is something that is can be practiced and managed, I think. I think that is within a human being's control.
Exactly. And so you might remember one of my previous books is Why So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders. So that talked about sort of like delusions of grandeur that become self-fulfilling. So yes, there is an adaptive nature for the individual in thinking that they're amazing when in fact they're not, but they can persuade other people of that. But vis-a-vis authenticity, it's important to understand, right? Because we praise people like Elon Musk and Donald Trump for seemingly behaving in authentic ways. Mostly they are actually being contrarian, rebellious, anarchic, and somewhat antisocial. And it's unfortunate that young people often extrapolate from this and say, wow, if I'm just rude and I just say whatever I think, that's not just freedom of speech, but that makes me an authentic leader. Actually, you know, even those people had to work very hard to get to where they are. And authenticity and the way that they displayed tends to be a privilege for the elite. You know, unless you are the status quo, you're not given license to misbehave in such way. And of course, I think it's a little bit unfortunate that leaders in that position misbehave and abuse their license to be themselves or to be contrarian. Sometimes we idolize them, but, you know, they're not very good role models. They would be better if they behave in unifying, pro-social ways and actually display true leadership qualities.
You write in the book that most of us inhabit multiple selves. And this made me think of the fact that there's certain thinkers from a very long time ago often who just keep popping up in their work. And Irvin Goffman for me is this. And And in part because of that, you know, I've been a theater guy my whole life, and he talks about that idea of an onstage, offstage, and backstage personality self. And there are many different selves, and I think we're just as human beings, we're desperate for things to be kind of black and white, for them to make sense. And when you add in all these variables, it makes less sense. But this gets to the core of what you're writing about in the book.
And, you know, Goffman was a genius. I mean, according to most, the father of sociology, but also wrote in beautiful manner and was so compelling and evidence-based. One of the concepts that I borrow from him and, you know, that I cite him on is this idea that we're always acting. We're always on stage. There's just two different forms of acting. One is what he calls surface acting, which is, you know, when you don't really believe the character you're portraying. And, you know, more often than not, that will reveal that you're a fake and that you're not genuine, and that will make you inauthentic. However, oftentimes we engage in deep acting, which is sort of like a form of method acting, is you truly are in character. And this, I think, is very important, right? Because the best leaders that I worked with and that I coach and that I see in organizations, and the best employees and managers, they have made their professional reputation feel real because they are immersed in that character. So they are almost like in character or on character all the time, but that doesn't mean that they're being themselves or that they're being authentic. In fact, they identify and they have learned to identify with their professional persona, and therefore they seem more genuine.
You might find this interesting. My colleague Jen Ellison has a term she uses for the kind of comedy we do at Second City, and she says a lot of places do thin jokes. Yep. We do thick jokes, which is the same sort of thing that you're talking about, which is we want a little bit deeper. It's still, you know, it might be a fart joke, but it's going to be the smartest one that you get, and it's that's the kind of funny we search for.
Yep.
So this is you write in the book that self-deception can be used for good as well as for bad. Tell us the ways in which that can be used for good.
Yeah. So, for example, you know, if self-deception starts with how you distort your self-concept. You know, it tends to consist in like thinking highly of yourself just because it inflates your self-esteem and it, you know, it kind of lubricates or boosts your ego. So, for example, you know, if I think of myself as a really generous person, even if I'm not, it will nudge me to behave accordingly, right? So you have a lot of philanthropists, and including self-made billionaires, no need to name anybody, who are engaging in huge philanthropy and donating a lot because they have a bit of a God complex. Granted, you know, it's easy to say, oh my God, you know, they're just narcissists in disguise and who are, but the point is they're giving away a lot of their money. That's certainly better than not being self-deceived and knowing that you're a stingy bastard and saying, oh, you know, I know myself. So, and like that, you know, generally speaking, people do seek more often than not to align their behaviors with their self-concept. So, you know, ideally your self-concept would also be shaped by the feedback you get from others, but the feedback you get from others is also based on your behaviors. So there is this kind of a nice loop, if you like, whereby it might start with you thinking, okay, I think I'm a creative person, therefore I will behave in creative ways. And if you manage to do that, others will reinforce your self-concept by saying, oh, that was quite creative. And then in the end, what started as a delusion or a self-deception actually becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So is that also the science of fake it till you make it?
In a way it is. In a way it is. I think, you know, there is a kernel of truth to fake it till you make it. You know, I think what's important is that you make it not just in your own mind, but you make it in the mind of others. And of course, you know, I think it was Abraham Lincoln and many other people, you know, this quote has been attributed to many people, that you can fool all the people one sometime and, you know, one person all the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. This is what actually ends up happening, right? So sooner or later, if you're not good and you don't have substance and it's all style and it's all deception, you will be found out. And unfortunately, as the world gets more complex and judging talent becomes more and more difficult and more sophisticated, it is easier and easier to fool people. You know, I spent a lot of time interviewing candidates for jobs. If you don't really know your trade, and if you haven't interviewed many, many, and you don't have tricky questions or a framework or something, they're going to be able to bullshit you no matter what.
Yeah, this is a conversation we've been having here because we're working on some strategy for the next 5 years. And we were talking about, you know, all these pie in the sky ideas and starting to try to put some numbers. And I was in a meeting today where I was like, are we putting the cart before the horse? And our CEO sort of reminded me, he's like, you know what? I just want to, we have to keep going or else we're going to kick the can down the road forever. So I don't mind that this is made up. I don't mind that it's good enough for now, but it's going to allow us to interrogate. And this is total improv thing because in improv, we're always teaching people just start a scene.
Yeah.
You know, like you don't need to, if you start thinking about what the scene is going to be or all that, you're going to get caught up. Just start it and let's sort of see where it comes. And that's part of the creative process. No different than our human behavior. We don't have scripts.
Yeah.
So how do you know if a conversation is going to go well unless you start a conversation with the intention of it going well and thinking it'll go well?
And you make me think, you know, I've been only recently watching Seinfeld, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, which, you know, I love. And a lot of the times he has stand-up comedians or other kind of improv people. And it made me think, you know, about how authenticity is reflected there. Because, of course, you are exposed. And if you're not funny within seconds, and if you don't believe in yourself, if the first joke or line backfires, you're toast.
You're done.
But at the same time, you have to have a plan. You have to have, you know, and I guess you cannot just be yourself. You know, you are on stage twice, once because of that concept, and then because you are really on stage and everybody's like, and yet people want to see if you're genuine. So I think, you know, the question remains the same, is to what degree can you curate your professional persona in a way that still conveys a unique element of your personality and that makes you seem real. That, by the way, is a super important point. It's not how authentic you think you are. It's how authentic other people think you are. So when people talk about, you know, whether it's Trump or Obama, usually they will say, oh, they're authentic if they're affiliated to their politics, which is, you know, that makes it very, very kind of subjective and inaccurate. But basically, we have no way of knowing whether Obama or Trump or Musk are truly being themselves and are being authentic, or if they're just putting it on. But the important thing is whether they are perceived as authentic by others. And that counts as a big, big bonus.
So I'm married to a professor of comedy. My wife, Anne, her new book's coming out in October, and it's her comedy theory book. So she talks about this specifically around stand-ups. So one of the things that stand-ups do is they have to do perspective giving. They have to teach the audience how to watch them. And if you go back to your favorite stand-up and look at their first Netflix special, they're always starting with their flaws.
Wow.
John Mulaney's a drunk. Yes. Amy Schumer's a slut. You know, like Patton Oswalt's a schlub.
Yeah.
And there is truth to that.
Self-deprecating humor is the key. Yeah.
And so you can anchor in that a little bit and then move around. Because the other thing is they're saying this from a stage.
Yeah.
In their Netflix special, so exactly, you know it's exactly. going to work out.
Exactly. Well, you know, and that reminds me, like, at the moment, back to the world of work, a lot of people are just, you know, suggesting or recommending to young folk looking for jobs that they have, or even more senior people, that they have a failure resume, meaning, you know, these are all the things that I did and I learned from failures. Okay, sounds great. Likewise, you know, for a while, people love to ask in interviews, tell me about your biggest weaknesses. And of course, you're not supposed to say, I'm impulsive, I hate people, I snore, and, you know, and I'm a sexist. You're supposed to come up with choreographed weaknesses that actually
I work too hard.
Exactly. You know, failure resumes is really difficult because unless you say, you know, I tried to IPO with this company and we only raised 200, not 1 million. And it's like, you know, I went for the Nobel Peace Prize, but I didn't get it. You are actually not going to go very far.
Yeah. That is a tricky balance. So how does EQ factor into all this? We hear a lot about emotional intelligence. Is that a real thing? Is it contain elements of this?
It is a real thing, much like, you know, if you read Goffman, you probably don't need to read my book on authenticity. And if you read, you know, kind of old books on empathy and social skills, you don't need to read modern research on EQ. But it's clearly the case that people differ in their ability to manage themselves, meaning control their emotions or strategically, you know, decide which emotions they display, and also in their ability to read others and how they impact in others. And, you know, the reason why I focus a lot on EQ, which isn't a novel concept, is because generally speaking, people who love EQ as a concept also love authenticity. And actually, the research shows that they are negatively or inversely related, which makes total sense, right? I mean, the epitome of somebody with high EQ isn't, you know, Tony Soprano or Donald Trump. I mean, it's like the Dalai Lama or the Queen of England, or now the King of England is a little bit lower in EQ. So you can see how he feels, right? He's somebody who is phlegmatic, who is cool-headed, who is calm, and sort of has this Teflon personality that whatever is a great poker player. Imagine if you actually leak your emotions and you're very transparent and authentic and you want to play poker. You just cannot do it, right? So that's the first part. And the second part is that emotional intelligence is also about self-control and about understanding how you impact other people. So the higher your EQ, the more able you will be to adjust your behavior in high-stakes situations. You will know how to break the ice. You will know what to say, what not to say. It's less likely that you engage in like social blunders and so forth. So if you think that by definition, high EQ people are inauthentic, except they're so good that they know how to come across as genuine when they're being fake.
So interesting. You had a line in the book that I chatted to our CEO, and it's, quote, kindness is not a management doctrine, but its absence is a management failure. I love that. Tell me why you wrote it and what you mean by juxtaposing those two things.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the inspiration for that was a book by a guy called Paul Bloom, who is a great psychologist and neuroscientist at Yale University. And he wrote a very provocative but great book called, with a title, Against Empathy, where he actually said, you know, we love empathy, but even empathy, if you think about it, is first not enough and almost counterproductive, because we evolved to basically inherit, our brains evolved this capacity for empathy that make us feel the pain and emotions in others who are genetically related to us or close to us in a cultural sense. So by definition, if your approach to exhibiting prosocial behavior and being kind is you have to feel empathy, you're not going to be very, you know, diverse or inclusive in your approach. You're only going to prioritize your next of kin and your own tribe. The world is already very divided for that, very polarized. So what he says is we have to make the case for rational compassion. And rational compassion is what inspired that quote, because, you know, actually it takes even some degree of inauthenticity to force yourself to be kind and nice to people that you might actually not feel so. And by the way, I'm not just including people who are from different races, nationalities, social class, but even people, think about even people who are at the other end of the political spectrum. It seems almost impossible to display any kindness towards them. In fact, employees are writing messages, you know, against hiring people if they don't believe in what they believe. It kind of makes the case for like the absence of that is a management and I think a cultural failure in a society.
It's interesting. Kirk Gray talks about this with regard to talking to people across the divide. And one of the two areas he talks about as successful is storytelling, but also shared harm.
Yeah.
And this idea of shared harm strikes me as very hard to be inauthentic in that when you are just telling a thing that happened to you where someone can be like, oh, that, like, I get that. And it sort of takes it down a little bit where you can maybe build from there. And I think even that has to be self-regulated, because if you come across as being using it to get that effect, it won't work.
Exactly. And I think also the expectation is that it happens in small doses, right? And it's precisely because it happens in small doses that you will get people's heart and not just minds to open when that happens, you know. Contrast that with the person who is all overdoing their vulnerability and always crying, complaining, etc. You know, I mean, you get two or three trials, but after that, you know, you'll just be an annoying or obnoxious colleague.
Yep. Here's another one that I love from the book. Quote, contrary to what people think, it is not honesty or truth, but the ability to trust people that we really care about.
Right.
So that people might understand the difference there. So yeah. Can you break that down a little bit?
So, you know, I think from a commonsensical or almost like intuitive logic standpoint, we assume that we trust people who are honest. But actually, you know, and you may have heard of like the concept of radical candor or radical transparency, where everybody says, you know, and Ray Dalio has a good TED talk on this, where he says, you know, well, we don't go as far as telling somebody who is showing you a picture of the newborn baby, your baby is ugly. But generally right. speaking, we speak our mind. And it's very good that he made that kind of nuance or covered there, because even they don't do it. The reality is that you're far more likely to trust somebody who is predictable and who makes you feel safe. And that person will probably understand very quickly what your boundaries are, what your triggers are, and that there are certain jokes, for example, that they shouldn't make. They would also be more focused on your well-being and your peace of mind than in their kind of a need to express themselves. You know, ultimately, a lot of this is like navigating the intricate tension or finding a balance between our desire to, or our right almost, because we feel it's a right to be ourselves, and what's good for others. And, you know, unfortunately, especially the Western world, but society in general is constantly telling us that we have to express ourselves. We shouldn't worry about what other people think of us. I think I tell the true story in the book of one of my employees who came to my office for a performance review wearing this t-shirt with the caption, "Just be you, they will adjust." And I know he was wearing it, you know, with good intentions, thinking that this was kind of a, you know, the epitome or a mantra for a happy culture and workplace. But it did tell me, you realize how narcissistic that is. First of all, if we all wear that t-shirt, the world doesn't function, let alone, you know, this company. But also, maybe you think you're the only person who should wear that t-shirt, and the rest of us have to adapt to you, which is even worse.
So there's an improv exercise that we teach,
yeah,
which I think kind of illustrates some of this, which is called thank you statues. So we have the group get in a circle. We ask one member to step inside the circle and strike a pose like a statue. And then we say, anyone else, the job is for you to come out, do a pose next to that person. They're going to say thank you, and they get to leave the circle. Go.
Yeah.
And what happens is people are really kind of reluctant to go in, and someone goes in and someone goes out. And then again, that person's inside for too long, and we stop the exercise and we're like, okay, so what are you know, on the outside, what are you thinking with that? And like, oh, we're not quite sure what we're going to do. And we say to the person inside, you know, what are you thinking? Just get in here and get me out. I don't care what you're thinking. I don't care you imagining my intent. I don't care. I want you to move your ass and get in here so I can get out. And it's a revelation. And what I love it, it's embodied, right? Because everyone sort of feels that sort of tension of that. And then as they do it and they're running in and they're running out, we say they're building trust, but really what they're doing, to your point, is no, you've shown them that you're going to just show up and do this thing.
Exactly.
I don't care what's in your head.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, again, you know, we trust people who can be good for us. We trust people who have our best interests at heart, even if they're doing so for pragmatic, functional, instrumental reasons, which is also very important, right? Because
right.
in the end, this idea even that tolerance isn't enough, we have to worship and embrace people who are different, that's ludicrous. You know, as the philosopher and sociologist Slavoj Žižek says, whatever happened to smiling to your neighbor when you see him, but bitching about them when you get home? It worked for millennia.
It's a time-honored tradition.
Exactly.
All right. You have a really terrific way of defining job performance, and you make it very simple. You say you define it through task performance and organizational citizenship.
Feels
to me like it covers everything.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, I wish it was my definition, but that's, you know, a kind of like the mainstream definition used in industrial organizational psychology. And I think it's a guy called Kevin Murphy that came up with it in the 80s or 90s. So credit to him. But yeah, it's important to understand, right? Because we think that we're hired to do the stuff that is in our job description, which says, you know, you will do A, B, and C, and your performance will depend on that, et cetera, which, by the way, increasingly with AI is becoming totally meaningless because we don't even know what people will actually do in the next 6 months, 12 months. We think we do, but probably they're changing. But anyway, that's task performance. But actually, more often than not, your promotion, your success, and even your task performance will depend on being a good organizational citizen. What does it mean? Again, it means understanding where the right to be you ends and your obligation to others begins. It means making sacrifices for other people. It means helping a colleague, even if it's not in your job description, and if it makes you waste time and you become less productive from a task performance. It means, you know, being not popular in the way of, you know, just sucking up and engaging in like empty kind of flattery and aggregation, but actually really being a good person and a colleague that others appreciate. And often that escapes, unfortunately, often that escapes, you know, the evaluation or the measurement of the value people add. And of course, often Machiavellian people and narcissistic psychopaths manipulate that through impression while being nice only to their bosses and getting promoted. But in a way, everybody knows, you know, when your peers evaluate you or when you ask your former colleagues to talk about you, that's the best measure of your organizational citizen. And by the way, people who score highly on that, they're not authentic in the sense of just sharing their unfiltered, uncensored self or ideas with others, or even imposing their values on others because they have no tolerance for other people and, you know, especially not bringing their whole self to work, which is a whole, you know, other issue.
All right. So how does all this wrap up in the DEI conversation that we're having right now in businesses and in universities? It's such a fraught topic because I think for many of us, you know, we want to be tolerant. Those of us who live in big cities and are around trans people and aren't scared of them, you know, feel like that's an important thing. And yet the data on the training is terrible.
Yeah.
So how can this help that conversation?
Yeah, we could have a whole program, you know, just on this because it's so big. But first of all, you know, when I was starting the book, there wasn't the backlash against the AI that happens now, but you know, that's almost like a distraction. It is a shame that the topic has been politicized and that if you speak in favor of it, you seem woke or lefty or Democrat or progressive. And if you are, you know, against it, you seem Republican, right wing, MAGA, etc. The reality is that I think every person, regardless of their political view, believes that organizations and societies where the best person gets the right job or is considered for the job, that's better, fairer, and more productive for the economy than positive discrimination, affirmative action, etc. Where people disagree is in the degree to which this is already happening or not, right? Mm-hmm. So when usually people on the right say, let's kill all D&I, is because they assume that if you don't have an intervention, automatically you get a meritocracy. And people on the other side, they assume that if you don't have an intervention, you get the opposite and you know people. I am more on the latter camp, but I still disagree with most of the interventions because even when they have good intentions, you have to judge outputs. And to your point, you know, the results have not been there. One of the connection with the authenticity kind of a book and criticism is that the whole bring your whole self to work kind of mantra and movement started as a well-intended diversity and inclusion or diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging intervention, thinking like, wow, it would definitely be nice if people who are part of the out-group, it doesn't matter what variable or what category, but you know, they're part of the out-group, so low status individuals, would feel free to share with their colleagues and to bring to the office who they really are, as opposed to feeling oppressed and alienated and having to fake it. Of course, who would not agree with that? That would be nice. Yeah. The problem is that it ended up being an attempt to actually throwing the ball at those individuals and telling them or pointing the finger at them, saying like, look, just be, tell us about your LGBT plus weekend, or tell us about your hobbies, or tell us about your weird habits, or, you know, the fact that you did. And first of all, most people want to preserve certain privacy. Mm-hmm. They don't want to share these things with others. Secondly, at times, even when people do, most of the times they will be punished for doing that. They won't be rewarded, because the situation is that if you don't create inclusion, then diversity doesn't function, you know, doesn't work. And of course, you know, if we take the imperative or the mantra serious, it's like, should you bring your whole self? What if I'm a fascist? Should I still bring my whole self? What if I'm a communist? What if I'm an anti-Semite? I mean, so there are certain categories that are excluded, but others that are not. Yep. And then in the end, you're not bringing your whole self. You're bringing the aspects that the status quo rewards. So there's a lot of hypocrisy underpinning that command. You know, and I think it's especially important that we educate young people as to the importance of creating a professional self. Even if you show up to the interview bringing your whole self, you're definitely not going to be hired. I mean, look at Elon Musk or Steve Jobs. They had to start their own companies because they were dispositionally unemployable.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then Jobs got fired from his own company
twice,
and came back and was a little better.
And again, apparently. I like to remind people he was Steve Jobs. You know, most of us are not.
Exactly. All right. This dovetails perfectly into our last question for returning guests, which is a thank you because story. Because really, this was based on specifically Richard Thaler saying to us after we did the Yes And exercise for he and his colleagues at the University of Chicago, I get it. This is, feels like a nudge, like for people, you know, behavioral economics. We know that people's default is to say no or do nothing. That's what Yes And. But how do you Yes And someone who you just don't agree with? How do you stay inside this kind of difficult conversation? We built this thank you because exercise built on research around gratitude and being seen. And if you can, you know, really make that attempt to see people, they will then reciprocate, which is something we've talked about, mirroring, reciprocation that happens with this.
Yeah.
Have you had that experience in your life? Do you have a thank you because story?
Of course. And I mean, you know, as I was thinking about this, because I knew this would come, I mean, it's almost like it happens very, very frequently. But, you know, I want to mention a recent colleague of mine with whom I probably disagreed 95% of the times on everything from strategy to execution to implementation. But we managed to create a really open relationship where we would confront each other, but always with respect. And, you know, there have been times where I was furious for losing an argument and not having my way. But I realized in the end that he was right. And I wrote to him and I say, listen, I know I was angry and I know I was annoyed, but I'm grateful for you, not just because it was the right thing to do, but also because you helped me question myself and change how I think about these things. By the way, that helped me a lot in the future as well, you know? So I think for me, you're much more likely to learn and become smarter and create knowledge or evolve if you listen and make an effort to hang out with people who don't think like you. That is very painful, and it does require gratitude, because if you don't do that, then it's much easier for them to be fake and to tell you, yeah, I agree with you. And then, you know, I always say people who avoid conflict generate a lot of conflict in the long run.
Yeah, it's hard and it's not pleasant, and so is going to the gym.
Yeah.
And later, it's what you needed.
Exactly. So, no pain, no gain.
No pain, no gain. The book is called Don't Be Yourself, Why Authenticity is Overrated and What to Do Instead. Tomas, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you again for having me.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.